We sit in hipster bars and discuss
if we're poetic enough.
We pet our neuroses till they curl up.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Sarah Willie Hill.
My name is Ashley Maritson.
And we are
Demons and Dames.
I went low for that one.
So today we are going to be talking about Empress Theodora.
Theodora, we adore her. She's an empress that I've never heard of, actually.
Really?
No, I haven't.
That's fascinating. She's one of the most kind of powerful women from the period of time that we're going to be looking at. So this is around 500 AD.
So what was she empress of?
So she was empress of the Byzantine Empire.
Ew. I think I know why I've not heard of her.
Are you going to tell me you don't really know what the Byzantine Empire was?
I don't know why they just didn't cover that at school. And I went to school in several different countries.
Well, the Byzantine Empire is kind of the Eastern Roman Empire. The term Byzantine Empire really comes into use only with modern historians because the people themselves would have just called themselves Roman, and they thought of their, you know, nationality as being, like, part of the Roman Empire.
Wow, it's weird to think that, you know, a few hundred years from now, we might be referred to as something else entirely.
You mean, like, the Scottish?
Or the Smurfs. I feel like I talk about Smurfs a lot. Why do contemporary historians consider it distinct from the Roman Empire?
There are a couple of reasons for this, and this happens over a period of about 300 years. So the nexus of power shifts, basically, from Rome to the east under Constantine, one of the most famous Roman empires.
I have heard of Constantine. I've seen his oversized statue. I know that he was the first Christian emperor.
Yes.
Yes, and he founded Constantinople.
And Constantinople was the capital of the Byzantine Empire. So it was the Eastern Roman Empire. During kind of the 300s on, the Roman Empire, what we think of as the traditional Roman Empire, mm-hmm. kind of goes into decline.
You get the Huns. Togas.
Yes.
Capitals.
What language?
Latin. Amo, amas, amat. Amamus, amatus, amant. Literally the only way you will ever get a public school boy to say I love you.
Much less 20 of them at the same time.
Yes. That, I'm not sure I could handle that, actually.
Sorry. And that's another kind of reason historians are looking at the Byzantine Empire and saying it's different, is because the nexus of power shifts, but also in the 600s, so after when we're talking about, and they changed the official language from Latin to Greek.
Whoa. What area does it cover?
You have kind of the traditional Roman Empire, so you have all of Italy, Northern Africa, you know, Greece, and then you're shifting over towards Constantinople, which is now called
Istanbul.
Istanbul!
Thank you, you've fed me that. I'm really grateful, because I don't think I'm actually going to know an awful lot from what you're saying this episode, so let me have these small victories where I can get. I've been to Istanbul.
You have?
There's lots of cats everywhere. I think maybe the cats think it's their city, and there's just lots of people.
There's, you know, the people of Constantinople saw themselves as God's chosen. Well, I was just thinking when you said there were so many cats, I feel like cats as a species think that they are God's chosen, so that's what made me think of that.
God's chosen. They'd have been Christian then.
Yeah. So Constantine, I think you said, was the first Christian empire. So there's a really cool apocryphal story about how Constantine converted to Christianity, which was basically, let's be honest,
acid.
A really weird cult kind of running around the Roman Empire.
I feel like I'd been quite down with early days Christianity.
Well, there was a lot of getting eaten by lions and stoned to death.
But also a lot of, like, intense chats in cellars.
Yeah, probably. Lots of letter writing, you know.
Ooh.
And Constantine had the vision of the Christian cross, and right before this famous battle, and he had his, you know, supposedly all of his soldiers paint the cross on their shields, and then they were victorious.
Such a simple shape. Oh, wait, I'm not going to say that. Take that back.
But by the time Theodora is born in 500 AD, it's actually the official religion. And this is a really important period of Western history with the rise of Christianity. I think the other thing that I wanted to kind of give for context, because it's really important to Theodora's story, is when you think of the Roman Empire, there's usually a and that goes with Rome.
I actually don't know what you're talking about. Oh, Romulus and Remus.
Okay, close.
Okay. Oh, bread and circuses.
Yes! I think it's important that we talk about circuses in this.
Bread and circuses. What does bread and circuses mean, Sarah? I know what it means, obviously. It's just for anyone who doesn't.
Okay, so traditionally, in and this is in Rome, not in Constantinople, everyone got a grain ration from the state, and they also got circuses. So any time you wanted to curry political power and get the mob on your side, you would throw these big gladiatorial fights. So we've moved from Rome to Constantinople, and it's become, the Roman Empire has become a Christian state, right? So under a Christian state, do you think you can have these kind of circuses where everyone's knifing each other all the time and you're basically watching people commit murder?
So there's no circuses. Yeah, I can see. Christians are not down with the whole idea of gladiatorial entertainment, especially since so many of them were eaten by lions in the arenas originally.
Exactly.
I also heard that Caligula, you know, Caligula, liked to, famously bonkers, Roman emperor, liked to dip Christians in wax and burn them like candles to light the games.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, it's full on, right?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I want to be a Christian in that precise period.
Yeah, I don't think so. Maybe a bit later. I think under Theodora's time, it's a lot, you know, it's the state religion and it's a lot more laid back. So circuses are still a really big part. It's the main entertainment, right? But the circuses have changed. And the way they've changed is they become more like what we would consider great entertainment, horse racing. And the height of this was the chariot race thing, kind of Ben-Hur.
Yeah.
And so what you kind of need to know as context in this is that there were four different groups of charioteers that used to compete against each other, and they were all named after colours.
When you say groups, you mean there was, like, it was more than an individual charioteer, it was a team sport.
Yeah, and it was, like, really intense. And they're named after the colours, so you had the red, the whites, the greens, and the blues.
Sounding an awful lot like a football strip.
It kind of is, and it's fascinating because it's really important for the story, but it's also important to understand the Byzantine Empire because you belonged to your team for life, and everyone belonged to a team. People really were passionate about their team, and you actually get full-on riots between the blues and the greens, especially, who we're going to talk about throughout this kind of story, where it got into politics, and it got into, you know, it's like if you think of the Yankees versus the Red Sox, but it determined who you voted for in local politics. It determined your religious preferences, even, and the type of Christianity you practice.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So I feel like that's really important context keep in mind.
Okay, that's interesting. So, Sarah, how much do we actually know about Theodora?
That's actually a really interesting question because, well, I find it interesting, but I'm a history geek. I might just be about to bore the socks off of you, so you can just fast forward 3 minutes.
Yeah, you know what? I can't, so let's keep it snappy.
That's a great question, because we know about her from a lot of different contemporary historians and historians that came after her, because she was such a big figure in the church. We'll talk about that later and how that happened. And there are a lot of different sources that fundamentally disagree.
Hey.
So, and also, I'm going to...
Contemporary sources that disagree?
Contemporary sources that disagree.
Ouchies.
So one of the main historical sources we have is this guy named Procopius, who was a contemporary of hers and her husband, the emperor. And he wrote three different books which talk about her. One of them was published in her lifetime, and one of them was published immediately after her death. And then there is a third one, aptly titled Secret History. No, we're not talking about Donna Tartt. Which was never published until 1623. So this is more than 1,000 years after her death.
But it was written by Procopius.
But it was written by Procopius, and a single manuscript of it survived.
Are we sure it's, like, the real deal?
That's a really good question. It's quite possible, and people think that he did write this as kind of a very vile, biased denouncement of this powerful woman, where he talks a lot about her sexuality.
Oh my god, I hate that stuff.
And he literally talks about her as being a demon, so she was certainly demonized.
Wow. Literal demon.
A literal demon.
Mm.
Then this is kind of found. Mm-hmm. There were quotation marks in there in case you couldn't see them, hear them. By monks in the early 1600s.
Yeah, okay.
And then it was kind of probably rewritten a bit.
Well, was it in the interests of anyone in the early 1600s to be throwing shade at Theodora?
I think it was... Well, it was the goddamn patriarchy, wasn't it?
Oh, Sarah.
But I think it was... It was good politically because this is what... She's a really big figure in which became the Eastern Orthodox Church. So this is being published in the Western Catholic Church.
Okay.
So they're throwing shade at her for that. They're also throwing shade at her because she was a fucking powerful woman.
Do we have many other sort of contemporaneous historical sources?
So we have a couple. So there's John of Ephesus, who is another contemporary that writes about Theodora, but he's writing about her in his Lives of the Eastern Saints. So so she's being demonized by Procopius, and then John's
pretty much bought into the Theodora myth.
As a saint. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, she's a saint, and the other hand, she's a literal demon.
Binary much? Wasn't she just a woman?
This kind of influences a lot of the stories we have about her are coming from these two sources that are really biased, even though they're contemporary, and then how these stories have been changed over the years. Because you get some historians around the 12th century that are writing about her as an actual saint as well. She even has her own saint day, which is November 14th.
Oh.
I think it's pretty cool. She's our first saint, Ash.
Oh my goodness. Demons, dames, and saints. Let's hold this episode back and release it. No, we need it. We need it for later. But basically, it's very much an open playing field from a historian's perspective in terms of what you can write about her, because she's such a sort of divisive character in her lifetime, the immediate aftermath of it.
Exactly. And we have so many different stories, and it's really hard to say what's true. So I've kind of put this together as best I can.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes I don't think something actually happened, but damn, I'm not going to let that get in the way of a great story.
Oh, right. So this is bullshit. I'm just curious, before we go any further, to know, why do you think we don't get taught about the Byzantine Emperor?
You know,
in well, certainly not in Britain. And yeah. I don't know if you got taught about it much in the US.
Well, this is kind of the first time today I realized that this wasn't really widely known. And that actually came from me spending 3.5 hours wandering around the British Museum looking for the Byzantium exhibition. And I found it in a corner of one room in less than a single, like, display panel.
I mean, that's nuts, given that it went on, you know, that it was as vaster than the Roman Empire.
It lasted over 1,000 years.
Is it because it's too closely affiliated with Eastern Orthodoxy?
Well, maybe it's just because the British colonials never went there and stole all the shit. I don't know.
You're right. I mean, you can't have an exhibition without some filched artifacts. What are you going to do? Interactive audiovisuals?
So do you want to hear about Theodora's life?
Yeah, absolutely.
So she was born in 500 AD. We think she might have been born in Syria or even possibly in Crete. But certainly by 503, she was in Constantinople and her family was established there. And you remember we talked about the Greens and the Blues.
Yes.
So her father...
And the whites and the reds.
And the whites and the reds.
I like it. It's a nice festive palette.
It really is. So we don't really talk about the whites and the reds so much because they're not kind of politically important for this. But the greens and the blues we're going to talk about.
You said that.
A lot.
Okay.
So her father was actually a bear trainer.
Stop! I can't... I'm sorry, I don't know what to do with that. I mean, how much training can... Okay, whoa. What did he train the bears for? The circus?
So these are the circuses. So that's kind of like a warm-up act for the charioteers, which are the main thing.
Okay.
And there was like, you know,
and the circus is tricks. Really an important part of, you
this
know...
This is social makeup, yeah. Constantinople at this period of time has a pretty rigid class structure. There are actually 10 separate classes with all of the actors and all the people that work in the circuses coming at the bottom okay. of this class structure. But at the same time, they could be really wealthy and really famous the way that we treat celebrities today.
But they'd still remain, they're essentially lower caste.
Yes.
Okay. So yeah, they wouldn't exactly. be able to, they might achieve renown, but they wouldn't be able to marry into a higher class.
Exactly.
They wouldn't be able to socialise outside so, the context. Oh, no, they might be brought along as a kind of oddity, but...
When Theodora was born,
be equal.
She's not allowed to marry anybody of the patrician class, for example.
Okie dokie.
Her father's a bear trainer, and okay. her mother is recorded as being a dancer or an actress of some sort.
Either way, scandalous.
We certainly know that the family was Christian. Theodora, her actual name in Greek, means gift of God.
That's nice.
I think it's pretty cool. Theodora's father dies when she is 3, and the family belongs to the Greens. And her mother actually marries the next bear keeper for the Greens.
Okay. That's, so,
you know, continuity.
Maybe that's what she likes in a man.
So when Theodora is roughly somewhere between the ages of, I think, 7 and 9 years old, I'm not exactly sure when.
That's 8.
Okay, so when she is approximately 8 years old,
okay.
her stepfather is fired as being the bear keeper of the Greens.
I hate to think what one would have to do as a bear trainer to get the sack.
Well, evidently it was a political move.
Okay.
So it was, like, really sketchy. And so what her mother does, and we don't actually know her mother's name, which I'm, because she sounds amazing, to be honest, so I'm quite sad that her name isn't recorded. She dresses up all 3 of her daughters. Theodora is the middle child, of course. And she dresses them in their best clothes, decks them out in flowers, and has them at the beginning of, before the chariot race, where the stadiums are full and everyone's there. She has them parade into the center of the stadium, decked out in these flowers, and they started on the green side, and she kind of prostrates herself very artistically in front of the head of the Greens and asks for her husband's job back. And everyone's, you know, you imagine everyone, like, cheering in the stadiums or booing.
You know, could hardly say no, really, could he?
Well, guess what he did?
He said no?
He said no.
Wow.
And so,
I would love to know why the dad got fired. You say it was political, so something it was presumably to do with someone doing someone a favour for someone else.
I think it was the head of the Greens' nephew that replaced him. It was definitely insidious like that. And so she marches her daughters to the other side of the stadium.
No!
To the Blues.
She didn't.
And prostrates herself.
You know what? It's been a long time since I really properly prostrated myself. I'm not even sure I know what it looks like anymore. Are you getting... I'm picturing a sort of kneeling...
Full-bodied bow.
Yeah? Arms out, crucifix style.
With, like, flower petals, you know, blowing in the wind.
I fancy that. Can I do that for you later?
Oh, God, that sounds amazing.
I'm not sure there's actually enough space in my apartment.
Well, we could always go outside in the grand.
I might catch something.
So the mother marches herself and her daughters across the stadium to the Blues.
The invisible line.
And prostrates herself in front of the Blues, flower petals waving in the wind.
Wow.
And of course he...
Well, damn straight he says yes. Way to make Mr. Green look bad.
He does indeed. And from then on, Theodora is a staunch Blues supporter entire life.
Or a true Blue.
She's a true Blue. Very, very good.
Thank you very much.
All 3 girls go into the family business. Theodora, as I said, is the middle child, so her oldest sister...
Dancer/actress/scandalous woman.
Yes.
Nice.
And they all work for the Blues.
Yeah.
And her sister is known as kind of this great, amazing beauty. She goes onto the stage when Theodora is only 12.
Okay.
And Theodora kind of goes into the business when she is 12 behind her sister. So she would have probably actually worn, like, a boy's tunic and carried her sister's stool around and things.
Okay, all right. Very much in her sister's shadow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But they're, you know, even though they belong to the lowest class, because they are part of, you know, the circus performers, they would have probably have been educated to a certain point. She was definitely literate.
And that's in order to be able to do their job well, which is to sort of delight people at... I mean, are they courtesans?
Well, depends on which history you're reading. If you're reading Procopius at the age of 12, she was too young to actually be a proper courtesan. He implies that she was going around having sex with all the slaves in the manner of a boy.
So why would you do that?
I think this is just, like, pretty
horrible
slander.
I mean, yeah, if you're going to slander someone, make it plausible. I mean, there's literally no good reason why a 12-year-old would do that.
I can't imagine any either. I think this was him going off the deep end.
Yeah, he just said the worst thing he could think of.
So Theodora is growing up in the theatre. She's learning how to write. She's literate. She may or may not be able to speak Latin, which was generally something, it was like the language of the court still at this period of time. Mm-hmm.
But nothing she like the court for clinging to a long dead language as a sign of distinction.
And she's watching her older sister, who is incredibly successful. As part of her job as an actress, according to a lot of contemporaneous sources and also historians now, although not everyone agrees, being an actress means that you were also probably working as a sex worker.
Okay. I mean, it doesn't seem entirely improbable. It's been the case for much of history.
And this is something that Theodora would have grown up with and would have been really normalized,
yeah.
I think. And she ends up joining the stage herself, probably around the age of like 15 or 16. And one thing we actually know about her, at this point, most girls would have been married at the age of 15 or 16. So that was kind of the normal marriageable age. And so that is when, instead of going into a marriage, because she wouldn't have had money for a dowry or a good marriage, she goes onto the stage.
So it's a point in which you make a choice, you know. And either way, it's a choice. It's about essentially trading in your body.
Exactly. And we do know that she was sexually active at this time because she has a daughter.
Okay, yeah, that's fairly incontrovertible.
So this was in between when she was either 15 or 16 years old. We're not exactly sure on the date. She has a daughter. The name is unknown, but we do know that her daughter ends up quite well. We just don't have a record of what her name was. And then when she's about a year later, when she's 17, she kind of reappears on the stage and she joins a mime troupe.
Oh my God, mime is so lame.
Well, I think the way that mime was done then, it would be a lot more what we think of being as burlesque.
Okay.
And this isn't, like, fancy word for stripping, though some historians have, like, done that, but more kind of traditional burlesque. So it was funny, it was political,
yeah.
It's performance art at, I think, a really high level.
You know, I might have done a spot of burlesque myself, actually, Sarah.
Oh, tell us about it, darling.
Well, I didn't do a great deal, but it was certainly funny, and it was certainly political. It did also involve some stripping, I'm not going to lie about that. But all in the purposes of making a serious point. And I had a good burlesque name, actually.
What was your burlesque name?
It was Curious Peach.
Ooh.
It was taken from a poem by Andrew Marvell called The Garden, because obviously if I'm going to do burlesque, I'm going to, like, take my name from a 17th century metaphysical poet.
I would expect nothing left.
And there's this great couplet where he goes, the nectarine and curious peach into my hands themselves doth reach.
Ooh.
Yeah. Maybe she was doing something like that.
Well, one of the stories we have about her and her most famous or iconic act was Leda and the Swan.
Oh my God. I love Leda and the Swan.
Can you just tell us briefly what's the story?
Well, I mean, my entry point's almost entirely the poem by Yeats, which is indecently hot for a poem about a woman having sex with a swan. Leda is... So the god Zeus sees Leda, likes what he sees, does as Zeus does, and transforms himself into a swan, picks her up, rapes her whilst airborne, and then drops her.
And the poet by Yeats make this all sound...
Yeah, there's this whole thing about great wings beating and kind of quivering feathery thighs.
I feel like we're
I'm not proud of myself, but I'm also not the only one. So we studied it at university. We all felt the same way.
I think this is something that Theodora probably would have been really into.
Yeah, I bet she was fully bringing out the sort of, like, you know, the sexiness of a story about a god transformed into a bird, raping a woman at 10,000 feet and dropping her to her death.
So she normally performed in the nude, except for a girdle or kind of a loincloth type thing.
A thong.
Probably a bit more substantial than
cloth
that.
Cloth thong.
Which we're pretty glad about when loin I tell thong. You what happens next. And she actually used a trained goose, or sometimes several geese, in her reenactments
not
of Leda and the Swans.
I wonder if her stepdad, the bear trainer, did a sideline in goose training.
I think geese are probably a lot smarter and easier to train.
I think that's a real assumption. How would you know that?
Because they were used as, like, guard dogs / geese in Roman times.
I didn't know that. That's insane.
Yeah.
You know, I can kill swans.
Can or may?
May. I don't know if actually emotionally I have it within myself.
What gives you the legal right to kill swans?
Because my college at Oxford, if you're an alumni of Christ Church College Oxford, you and the Queen can kill swans. So if you've got a swan, anyone needs got a swan you need taking out, I just won't be able to do it. But I could get someone else I went to college from my college and maybe they'd be interested.
So going back to Theodora and her amazingly trained geese.
Yeah.
She would lay out grains leading to her privates, and she would put grain in her loincloth area for them to delicately pack out, which is why I'm hoping this is quite a thick loincloth for her sake.
I can imagine people paying to see this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I saw something like this at the end of Fringe once, actually.
Is that the show we went to where someone pulled a hero out of their...
I love it when you call it that. No, it wasn't, but the fact that we said that was the year before.
So I have a great description from Procopius about her art, and he's so vile. Do you want to hear it?
Yeah, definitely.
He says, often, even on the stage, she stripped before the eyes of all the people, and stood naked in their midst, wearing only a girdle about her private parts and groin. Not because she had any modesty about showing that also to people, but because no one was allowed to go on stage without a girdle around those parts.
What? So he's saying that she's wearing it because she has to, but she would have taken it off if she'd had any option about it.
Yes.
Any choice in
that's
matter.
Exactly what he said. He says, then,
conjecture in that.
In this attitude, she would throw herself down on the floor and lie on her back. Slaves, whose duty it was, would then pour grains of barley upon her girdle, which trained geese would then pick up with their beaks one by one and eat. She did not blush or rise up, but appeared to glory in this performance, for she was not without shame, but especially fond of encouraging others to be shameless, and often would strip naked in the midst of the actors, and swing herself backwards and forwards, explaining to those who had already enjoyed her, and to those who'd not, the peculiar excellences of that exercise.
He's really just describing her doing her job, isn't he?
But she enjoyed it, Ash, and that's why she was a demon.
I think it's good to love what you do, man. You know, I just think that's... Like, how many people really enjoy their work? We're applauded where we find it.
Procopius also talks about her sexual proclivities as an actress.
Okay.
And he accuses her of taking the active male part on more than one occasion. He also describes her having sex with up to 70 people in a night, where he describes... I know. He was really laying it on thick.
Yeah.
Where he describes her going to these lavish banquets and basically fucking all of the important men, and then when they could take it no more, she would start on the servants.
I mean, what's a long night out, you know? Let's say she gets there at, like, what? I mean, it's, you know, I imagine they probably stop quite late, like 10, and you go to like 6 a.m. That's 8 hours, you know, divided by, I mean, that's like 8 or 9, you know, that's 8 people an hour. I don't think that's like less than 10 minutes each. I mean, if she's hard at it from the moment she arrives, I don't think that's possible.
I think a Guinness World Record at the very least.
I don't think Guinness actually covers that.
Edward Gibbon, famous classicist, you know, much more contemporary to us than Theodora, I think very beautifully put it, where he wrote that Theodora wishes for a fourth altar on which she might pour libations to the god of love.
Wow.
Caesar Baronian, a cardinal and church historian who was writing in the 16th century, wrote that Theodora surpassed all other women in wickedness. She deserved the name given to the furies of hell. So I think the church has been spending a lot of time and energy arguing about her sexual proclivities.
That's not a... So she's not even though she's a saint, she's not universally lauded within the church. So she's only a
saint in the Eastern Orthodox Church.
Okay, and
she
was a Western
cardinal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. That was a great question. When she's 18, she, if we're kind of to believe the general narrative, which again, it's divided, because in all of the Christian writings about her life, contemporary Christian writings, they don't talk about any of this. So it's really hard to establish fact. But she starts to develop more intimate one-on-one relationships with more wealthy and powerful men. And this is something that Theodora, it's kind of like, you know, dating training wheels for her, for the big leagues.
Okay.
Because we'll get there.
Okay.
And so when she's 18, she kind of gets her first monogamous relationship, really, with someone who is a really wealthy merchant.
So she finds a patron.
And his name is Hesepolis. And he was a really important merchant. And he's actually given a governorship in Northern Africa. And Theodora decides to give up her life on stage and go with him. You know, it's quite a long journey, difficult journey, and goes out and stays with him. Over the course of about a year, their relationship breaks down. A lot of the church historians that are kind of writing about her as a demon say that the relationship broke down with Hesepolis because she had insatiable lust and could not possibly contain herself to one man.
Okay.
Because, you know, she was a 7D dicks kind of girl a night.
Getting done up the bum by the slaves again.
Yep.
Aye. A 70 dicks a night kind of gal.
We don't really know why the relationship fell apart. One modern historian that I read that I really liked said that, you know, she was basically treated as his de facto wife, which means she would have been confined to the house. She wouldn't have been able to go out by herself. And she was probably just really fucking bored.
Yeah, wait. I mean, what's... After a life on the stage, which, you know, I imagine was a lot more a far more liberated experience than that afforded, clearly, to most Byzantine women.
Yeah. But we do know that the relationship falls apart and... with what I think shows kind of amazing gumption on her part, she fucks off and leaves. And it's not like she's leaving with a chest of jewels or anything. She's basically got the clothes in her back, maybe a little bit of jewelry.
So she has to make her way all the way back from North Africa to Constantinople alone.
In 518 AD, without resources.
Crikey.
It's kind of amazing.
So she hitchhiked?
Kind of. So she ends up in Alexandria first, which was kind of the biggest, closest big city to this weird governorship somewhere in Northern Africa. And she becomes really chummy with some leading, really powerful theologians in the Monophysite Christian church. And she becomes kind of a devout convert to their form of Christianity. And two of the people that are really important is Severus, who... not the Snape, who is just, he's a famous thinker, priest, theologian of the time, and also the head of Alexandria, Alexandrian government, and also the head of the Alexandrian church, the Patriarch Timothy.
And so is the Monophysite church a denomination of the Christian church?
Yes.
Okay.
So because in early Christianity, you have a bunch of different kind of warring factions that are arguing about what Christianity is and what the dogma is, and that's really happening a lot because it's still developing.
So she becomes good pals with these senior Alexandrians.
And she learns a lot about the Monophysite church. She also starts performing again. We think she joins a local mime troupe.
Mm-hmm.
And she starts touring around with them, kind of slowly making her way back to Constantinople. There's another really important person she met on her travels.
Okay.
And that was Macedonia, who was a prestigious dancer. Macedonia was both a really famous dancer, and she was also a spy.
Stop. Mata Hari.
I know. That was kind of, that was immediately who I thought of.
Who's she spying for?
So she is a spy for, dun-dun-dun, Justinian, who becomes very important.
Okay.
Shortly.
I don't know who Justinian is.
Well, I'm not going to ruin the surprise for you, but the background is the current emperor at this period of time is Justin.
Okay.
Justin the First, who was born a pig herder.
Oh my God. What about this class system?
Well, he worked his way up through the military.
Of course, that's and the way you get around that.
Yeah, so he was a pig herder somewhere not from Constantinople, but from further out in the empire. I don't remember where exactly. And he became a general because he worked his way up through the army.
So you could become a very famous performer, but not work your way up the class system, but you could become a successful general.
You can. And so when the last emperor died, The emperors were generally elected by the Senate.
Yes.
So it's not always hereditary. And there was almost a civil war over who was going to become next emperor.
Okay.
And
so it was a close one. You could say he was Justin.
Very good.
Thanks.
Well, he wasn't actually one of the two leading candidates.
Oh, wow.
He was kind of the third compromise candidate that was picked.
Yeah.
And so what he does is he sends back he doesn't have any children of his own, so he sends back to his hometown, to what is now a fairly prosperous farming family.
Okay.
Because, you know,
sending funds home.
And he brings his nephew into Constantinople and trains him up as a lawyer. And as soon as he's emperor, so Justin is the emperor.
Yes.
And then his nephew is Justinian.
Okay.
Who changes his name as soon after his uncle. And he becomes a lawyer, and he's also kind of the right-hand man.
Okay.
So he's helping run the empire, and he has these network of spies all over the empire.
Oh, he's a spy master.
Yeah.
Ooh.
And so Macedonia, this beautiful erotic dancer, is actually a spy.
Have you ever had someone tell you they're a spy?
No. I feel like that's a really bad pickup line.
Yeah, I've had a couple of people tell me they're spies. I mean, you can't be, right? If you're a spy, you don't tell people you're a spy.
Exactly. And so Macedonia recruits Theodora into her spy network.
I wonder if there are lots of dancing spies. I guess, you know, the good thing about a dancer spy is she spends time in the company of powerful men.
Exactly. So she would have been an amazing source of information. And we already know Theodora is ambitious, and she's smart, and she's literate. And
this is setting a precedent that Mata Hari will suffer for.
Unfortunately, yes.
Many years later.
Theodora ends up much differently. So the rest of her trip back to Constantinople, we don't know a lot about it. I think it would make an amazing film, all her adventures, as she's kind of traveling around with this band of actors, being a spy.
Love a road trip movie.
Yeah, and then she ends up back in Constantinople in either 520 or 521. So she's only 20 or 21 years old at this point.
Right, so this has basically been like one hell of a gap here.
Yeah, and she did so many incredible things in her life, but part of me is just astounded that at that age, you know, she spends basically 2 years wandering around the empire, a woman alone, just having complete agency over her own life.
Yeah.
At a time where we think of women as not having that option.
Mm.
So I think she's pretty fucking incredible, even at this age.
Okay, what's going to happen next?
Well, she meets Justinian.
Justinian.
So Procopius has kind of an interesting quote to introduce the next period of her life coming in. And he said, a dream had come to her during the night just past and had bidden her to lay aside all anxiety as far as wealth was concerned. For as soon as she should come to Byzantium, she should lie with the Lord of Demons. That's Justinian, by the way.
I assumed as much.
And would quite certainly live with him as his married wife, and would cause her to be mistress of money without limit.
I mean, you're saying it in a nasty voice, But if it weren't for the, you know, describing him as a demon, this all sounds really, really, really great.
I know. I think it's pretty fabulous. I think Procopius was maybe a little up his own ass. I'm just gonna say that. So Justinian was about 40 years old at this time. He was still unmarried.
Prime of his life.
He was a vegetarian. He was very healthy.
Okay.
And he was a bit of a geek.
Took care of himself. Oh, bless.
Yeah, he was...
Oh, she must have blown his socks off.
And he was really capable. He was really intelligent. He was really, really into theology.
I feel like he was a bit of a workaholic.
Totally. And so she comes to meet him. You know, she's been spying for him around the empire, and she comes to meet him at the palace, and we don't really have a story of what happened next, but...
What's his theological bag? Is he into monophysite Christianity, which, of course, Theodora's big on?
So he was actually a Chalcedonian Christian, which had a lot of fights with the monophysites.
Oh my god, so many flavours of Christianity.
I know.
Oh, it's like a Haribo Starmix bag.
So they really get on. But again, as we said, she can't marry him. So they live in sin in the palace.
Why can't she marry him?
Because she is from the lowest class.
Oh,
and he's a
that.
Patrician.
Oh, but so even it's... though, actually, his family were all swineherds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
sure.
you know now,
what? Sometimes I question class systems.
Now
I'm
they're the royal
sure
family.
They make that much sense or are, in fact, all that fair.
Huh. It's interesting you say that, actually. I don't think anybody's going to agree with you here. Except everyone. So they get together by 521, and within 2 years, they're living together in the palace, and they've managed to change the law.
Because it was actually illegal for people to marry outside their class. It wasn't just socially taboo.
It was actually illegal.
Wow.
And so Justinian goes about convincing the Senate to change the law.
I'd find this romantic if it weren't for the fact that, you know, it's such an abuse of power.
Well, I think it's quite good because it sets a really amazing precedent. So the law didn't just help pave the way for Theodora herself, although, fuck, it did. They actually get married in 525. We don't know the exact date of the wedding, but I'm sure it was fabulous.
Oh, yeah, I bet it was. I hope she danced at her own wedding.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Yeah, I wonder if the geese were invited.
She was quite famous for a fan dance as well.
Wow, is that... That's an old thing?
I think so. I don't know if that's, like, apocryphal or if that's actually accurate, but it could be. I've definitely seen her portrayed with two giant ostrich feather fans.
It's hot in that part of the world. Makes more sense there than it does in Britain.
That's probably true.
I do a mean radiator dance. I just, like, put my whole body against it and stay there for half an hour.
It's very erotic. So she actually helps a lot of her family, including her daughter and her older sister.
Oh, it sucks to be her older sister. Not the shining light now.
So they get married in 525. The year before this, Justinian falls ill with some sort of prostate something issue, and he's told by the doctors he's never going to have children. And unfortunately, they're right, because Justinian and Theodora never do have children, so she's only has the one daughter that she had when she was 15.
That is so sad.
But you know what? I think Justinian and Theodora are, like, an amazing, amazing power couple.
Yeah.
That show that you don't need children to be happy or to be awesome.
That's an outrageous thing to say.
So 2 years after the marriage, old Justin... the ex-pig farmer turned emperor, there's a story, falls dead at the ripe old age of 90-something.
Bloody hell, that's a good innings.
Yeah. And Justinian and Theodora are jointly crowned emperors.
So I thought generally the emperor was elected.
So they are, yeah.
But in this instance, presumably because he was considered a worthy successor.
Yeah. So the Senate confirms him as the emperor, and then they have a big ass ceremony.
Okay.
And Theodora gets crowned alongside him, which I think shows, if you're someone like Procopius, you use this to show what a wily demon she really is, and that she has, like, lulled his brains with her, I don't know, fucking gold vagina. But I think it really shows how much he used her as a confidant. Yes. And probably because she was supplying him for information before they even met, they've kind of established the basis for this relationship.
And do you think it was unusual that she was actually crowned alongside him?
It was unprecedented.
So generally,
at this period of time,
the empress would be much like, say, Prince Philip is to the queen. They'd be, you know,
exactly. They're supportive, waving, smiling.
But they were very much
saying racist things.
The title and sharing the throne.
Yes,
such as it were.
And she had her own seal, her own royal seal. She could, she had her own courtiers. She, again, I don't think this is a real story, but it's pretty cool if it was. She would actually make the bureaucrats, like, come into this really small, uncomfortable room and wait for her so that they would start, like, sweating and get nervous before they were allowed into her presence. And then she would make them kiss the arch of her foot.
Oh.
Before she spoke to them. And sometimes she would just leave without speaking to them.
I love the arch of her foot.
I know. Yeah. I think it's a brilliant touch. Don't know if any of that's true. So from the moment that Theodora becomes empress, she really is a co-ruler with Justinian. And she is an avid
painter-decorator.
She's an avid trailblazer in women's rights. And that starts initially as kind of, she declares kind of a war on prostitution.
Okay, and that's representing women's rights?
Well, it isn't really a war on the prostitutes themselves.
Okay.
It's a war on kind of the institution of prostitution, especially brothels that employ slaves, where they didn't have a choice. And this isn't looking at actresses or courtesans. This is looking at women that are either through the institution of slavery.
Sex slaves.
Literally sex slaves, or women that were forced for economic reasons to be prostitutes, and girls that didn't have dowries, and so that was an economic necessity.
I'm not sure there's an enormous difference between a sort of 15-year-old courtesan from her background going into this kind of work she did, and someone forced from economic necessity.
She saw a big difference legally.
Okay.
And so she sets up convents of repentance, is what they're called. But they're basically shelters for women that they can go, where they can earn money, they can be on their own.
Okay.
And they can escape prostitution if they want to.
Okay. And when you say it's a convent of repentance,
that was what it was called.
I mean, that doesn't sound great. I'm getting a strong sort of, like, you know, kind of Magdalene sisters vibe.
This is, you know, the early Christian church.
Okay.
And adultery is one of the kind of the cardinal sins, literally. So I think that's where it comes from. But as far as we know, the women weren't indoctrinated. Theodora made sure that there was a lot of wealth going into these centers.
So these weren't punitive institutions. These were genuinely dedicated to
women's welfare.
Okay.
And what we would have thought of as women's welfare at the time. Theodora saw what was referred to as kind of common prostitution as a economic problem and a problem with the dowry system, where families had to pay men to marry their daughters.
Yes.
Which is so fucked up on so many levels.
And so how did she redress that, other than offering sanctuary to those who'd been a victim of that system?
She removes any laws that prevented marriages between unequal classes. She put in laws so women could inherit property for the first time. She put in laws, well, so women could own property, not just inherit it.
Okay.
And
so you weren't entirely stranded if your father died and you were unmarried.
Exactly. So, you know, for example, her own mother, who is widowed, basically might have been fairly forced to marry the next bear trainer.
Yes, you know, like she was like, you get a pension plan, private medical insurance, and a wife.
Exactly. And so Theodora put through a lot of social changes and legal changes into the system.
She wouldn't be able
to
ban the dowry system. That would be more of a social convention, but she was able to give women some financial empowerment. Yes.
Exactly.
Some resources of their own.
And in 1535, Justinian actually wrote, "In the service of God, there is no male, nor female, nor freeman, nor slave." And I think that encapsulates really nicely the kind of the social premise of equality that they were pushing out under and kind of through a Christian doctrine.
So it's a really kind of theological egalitarianism.
Yes. There's another law that they have that is kind of interesting, that women were no longer sent to prison because there was a really a huge problem of women being raped by male guards in the prisons. And so they were actually sent to nunneries as punishment.
Okay.
Instead, which, you know, if that is
the alternative. I mean, it's the lesser of two evils, I suppose.
Another big one is that women could no longer be killed by their husbands for adultery, which used to be legal. So instead, if a woman was caught being adulterous, she would be sent to a convent for 2 years.
A convent of repentance.
Actually, I think just a normal nunnery.
Yes.
And then after 2 years, if her husband had forgiven her, she was allowed out.
It's really interesting, isn't it? So the church is essentially, like, Theodora is really using the church as a sanctuary for women.
Yes, completely. And presumably, if the husband doesn't want her back after 2 years, then she's allowed to stay in the nunnery, which means that she's safe, she's provided for, and she's given a certain level of support and care.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, they also...
I mean, it's not ideal that, you know, it's a choice between wedded to him and wedded to God, but...
It's better than...
At least it's another death choice.
Yeah. Yes. Which was the custom previously. Also, this is kind of a funny one. It used to be that not only was the adulterous wife killed, but also her lover. And they changed the law so that they could only kill a lover if there had been 3 official written warnings to the lover and they had all been ignored.
Oh, I wish some of those were survived. Isn't that amazing? This kind of like bureaucracy involved in something that... Something so kind of...
Tawdry.
Know. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I'm sure somewhere there are, like, records of this, which is how we know it.
I mean, I wonder if there's a formula you needed to observe, or if you could just sort of, you know, write your own standard death threat.
You could do it in verse.
But it would presumably be in Greek by this period.
Yes. Greek verse, do not fuck my wife or I will kill you. Warning number one.
That sounds like a plausible Greek poem.
There's also a really cool story where Theodora arranges the marriage of Saturnius, who is the son, like the son of a distinguished bureaucrat, and she arranges the marriage of one of her actress friends. And
interesting, that's a sort of Latinate name because, as you said,
yeah,
upper classes would have still been speaking Latin.
Exactly, and he evidently complained to his friends that Theodora's choice of bride was not a virgin.
Well,
and she was so offended by this that she had him tossed in a blanket and caned like a schoolboy.
I mean, presumably it was a hypocrisy that offended her, because I'm imagining
exactly.
He was not a virgin himself.
Exactly. And Procopius...
But you could see Procopius definitely would not like this story.
Procopius tells us the story pretty gleefully to assert that from then onwards, men lost all control over their wives. Oh, the horror.
Oh, the horror.
There's another really important bit, and this is from 532 in January.
So she's young. She's, what, 32?
Yeah, she's 32.
It's nice that she's, you know, born in 500.
It makes it so easier.
It's really easy.
So this is when we have the Nika riots. So do you remember the Greens and the Blues?
Damn straight.
So... This whole riot stems from a fight that went wrong, possibly in a bar. We don't really know where the epicenter is between the Blues and the Greens, and they start rioting against each other. And it gets really serious really, really quick in about the space of a month.
Presumably because there's a lot of... Oh, wait, so it's going on over the course of about a month.
Yeah.
So what, there's little...
And it builds and builds and builds.
And presumably there's a lot of long-standing tension between these two communities.
But can you imagine, like, the Yankees fans and the Red Sox fans, like, burning New York over, like, one baseball game? Because that's essentially what happens. It's kind of fascinating. And they start setting fire to buildings.
Yeah.
The Senate gets so freaked out by what happens that they actually join the mob and they try to put up another emperor. And Justinian and all of his supporters are about to flee the fuck out of there.
Wait, so is Justinian preferred by the Greens or the Blues?
Blues.
Okay. So the Senate are so frightened that they join the Greens.
Well, they join the mob in general at this point.
Okay.
And we're not sure if it's just the Greens or if it's just everyone rioting against everyone. Because it just gets... It kind of starts out as this green versus blue, and then it's just like everyone's fucking in the street with pitchforks and everything.
And everything that anyone's ever been upset about.
Exactly. Yeah. They've set fire to the palace. Ooh. And Justinian is like... packing up the gold and silver chests with his supporters and is like, let's get the fuck out
of here,
babe.
Let's get the hell out of Dodge.
And Theodora walks into the fucking Senate.
In a loincloth.
I think she's probably just wearing a purple robe. That seemed to be her kind of...
Oh, so they kept that.
Normal thing at this stage. And gives a fucking amazing speech that stops the riot that's happening in the Senate and convinces Justinian and all of his supporters to stay and to fight and to basically send in the troops and put it all down.
Presumably somewhat spontaneous, not something you could... Should have had a lot of time to prepare for. Have you got the speech?
I do, actually. We have...
Is it as good as Elizabeth I at the Armada?
Well, I'm going to do my best.
Okay.
Okay? Right. Are you ready?
I'm really, really ready.
My lords, the present occasion is too serious to allow me to follow the convention that a woman should not speak in a man's council. Those whose interests are threatened by extreme danger should think only of the wisest course of action, not of conventions. In my opinion, flight is not the right course, even it should bring us to safety. It is impossible for a person having been born into this world not to die. But for one who is reigned, it is intolerable to be a fugitive. May I never be deprived of this purple robe, and may I never see the day when those who meet me do not call me empress. If you wish to save yourself, my lord, there is no difficulty. We are rich. Over there is the sea, and yonder are the ships. Yet reflect for a moment whether, when you have once escaped to a place of security, you would not gladly exchange such safety for death. As for me, I agree with the adage that the royal purple is the noblest shroud.
Oh, given that she, you know, she's really grown to inhabit her role, hasn't she?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, she's not actually been the empress for terribly long, 7 years, and yet there she is. As if born to it.
Standing up to the whole Senate.
Rather preferring a purple shroud.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's pretty impressive.
I like the bit she says about how, you know, we're all going to die.
Yeah.
That's good.
And she's like, well, damn, bring it. I'd rather be dead than not be empress.
And that did the trick.
Unfortunately, between 30 and 35,000 people over the course of the riots and then them putting down the riots.
Do you have any idea what sort of proportion of the population of Constantinople at the time that would have been?
I think...
Because that it feels like that must have been quite...
I think we're actually looking at like 235,000 people here, so it is massively significant.
Good lord, the streets must have just been filled with corpses.
Yeah.
And that wasn't an invading army, that was shopkeeper against shopkeeper.
This is basically a football riot that got really out of hand. So they actually, the whole palace was burned down, and a lot of the city is burned down, and much like the London Fire and lovely Christopher Wren, who has left his stamp on London.
St. Paul's.
Indeed he do. And Justinian and Theodora set out to on a building spree.
Is that, you know, that very famous mosque that was previously a cathedral in Istanbul? Is that when that was constructed?
So I think you are referring to the Hagia Sophia.
Yes, that is correct.
Exactly. So this is the epitome of Byzantine architecture. And it was built by...
Theodora!
How cool is that?
That is really cool. Because, you know, I remember going there like 10 years ago and now, you know, not really knowing anything about it now.
Or knowing who she was. That's amazing.
Who she was, yeah.
So Theodora and Justinian used to very publicly argue in the Senate. So one of them would take up one point, the other would take up the other. Some people thought these were scripted, but it kind of shows that they had a relationship that was always really for each other. They were always working for each other and for the empire. But they didn't have to kind of feel like they had to toe the line. And I think that also is really amazing, and it shows kind of the power and the capacity for thought that she had. If she's going, you know, she didn't even speak Latin growing up, and so presumably these arguments are happening in
her
second language, which would have been, you know, everyone that she's...
Latin is the great rhetorical language as well.
Yeah, and everyone that she's performing these or having these debates in front of would have known it from almost infancy. They would have been trained in it. And I just think that kind of shows you a bit the depth of her brilliance and her nerve
of being able to do that. She was always a performer, you know, from a young age. She was being put in front of crowds as a way of making things happen, you know, decked out in flowers and popped into an arena,
exactly,
covered in purple, and shoved into a brawling senate, or shoving herself, rather.
In 542, so when she's 42 years old, the bubonic plague comes to Byzantium, which is really horrible for the city. Oh, that's where I get the 230 figure from. Mm. That's not the population of Constantinople. That's the population of how many people died in the bubonic plague. So as many as 230,000 people were reported dead in Constantinople of the bubonic plague, and Justinian himself falls ill.
Oh no.
He does not die.
He must be fairly getting on a wee bit in his 60s. Yeah.
He does not die, but Theodora steps in and becomes sole ruler during his illness, which is something that's pretty much unprecedented. And I think shows how much she was respected.
That these people identify themselves as Romans, you know, that means that you've got thousands of years of empire before where you've never had a female ruler.
Exactly. And Theodora, you know, who was born in the lowest caste of society, just steps in and does it.
Incredible.
Another area that Justinian and Theodora didn't agree on is on the religious side. So she is supporting the Monophysites, and he is supporting the Chalcedonians.
Okay.
And they're actually sending out missionaries of these two different bits all over the empire to try and, like, gain more followers.
Oh, wow. That's quite... It's like fantasy football. I don't really know. Another football reference. I really should have stayed away from that. But I can imagine that getting a bit competitive, right?
I think it was really
competitive. It's like when you've got a couple and they're both doing a marathon and they're both trying to get sponsorship for it.
Yeah.
You know?
In the short term, Theodora is doing pretty well. There's a famous instance where the Duke of Thebaid gets their emissaries first from Justinian. The missionaries have come, and Theodora has sent missionaries to the same dukedom, and she basically sends him a message saying, like, if you don't delay Justinian's, I'm gonna, like, fuck you up. And he does. does everything he can to kind of, without actually, like, obviously pissing off the emperor, he does what the emperor wants.
I thought, you know, like, clearly they're both very serious about their faith. How are they able to coexist whilst essentially trying to, you know, staging a kind of conversion wars against each other?
I think because fundamentally, Justinian saw this as just like an issue of dogma. That they could, you know, all get around a table together and eventually do. I mean, there's a lot of actual inner sectarian violence in the early church around this. But I think fundamentally they shared the same beliefs. It's just the dogma and theology is slightly different.
Okay.
So there's another funny little episode where Anthemus, who's a famous Monophysite, is summoned basically just Justinian's court to answer for some things that he's written that are supposedly against the dogma that Justinian believed in.
Okay.
And because he's like a pal of Theodora, she whisks him off and he never shows up. And Justinian only finds out 12 years later after her death that he's been in the palace this entire time and she had been hiding him in the women's quarters.
I mean, what would Justinian have done with him? I mean, was it a sort of threat of death?
It's not recorded, but he was certainly in trouble. Okay. He was certainly going to be, like, heavily reprimanded, if nothing else.
I love the idea of the guy in the woman's quarters.
I know.
Wonder if he was, like...
For 12 years! I think that is amazing.
I bet he had a ball.
He probably did. Or maybe he just kind of sat in his room and wrote theology and prayed a lot. Like, who knows?
Well, maybe that was his idea of having a ball.
There is that.
Each to their own.
So, unfortunately...
So, I think there was a bit of a spoiler alert there. You said that Justin Ewan would only find out after she died.
Yeah.
Presumably because Anthemus came out.
Found out, or they finally went into the women's quarters and were like, there's this old theologian
like
in the back there.
There's like 26 ancient theologians in here.
He hasn't had a haircut in 12 years. It's, you know, it's pretty nasty. So on the 22nd of June, 548, when she's 48 years old, Theodora passes away of what we now think to have been breast cancer.
What do we know about the symptoms?
Well, she's described as having a supplanting ulcer or malignant tumor about the chest area.
Oh, dear.
And there's a really famous portrait of her, which is actually in Ravenna, and it's a mosaic portrait. So if you kind of type in Theodora of Byzantium, it's probably the first image you get. And this was actually done in mosaic the year before her death. And it's, you can actually see in the portrait, compared to the other courtiers and the other women in it, that she does have a very kind of thin, almost gaunt face. And a lot of people think that she was already quite ill by the time that that portrait was done. Justinian very publicly wept bitterly at her funeral. And this is a time when that was considered to be very against custom.
Mm-hmm.
And he just kind of sobbed. And I think no one has ever written anything to doubt her faithfulness to him or vice versa. And I think that their partnership was one that was built really deep love, but also respect.
Yes.
For each other.
Yes. That certainly sounds like it. The sort of the power that he afforded her, the way they managed to coexist so merrily for so long. I mean, that's no mean feat. I've not been able to be in a band with a boyfriend, let alone run an empire with him.
I think it's pretty amazing. Her body was later buried in the Church of the Holy Apostles in Constantinople.
You've told me that Procopius wrote two books while she was alive, or rather one when she was alive and one immediately after she died. And then in this later one, they found the early 1600s, he's effectively demonised her.
Completely.
Is that very much the popular opinion already by that period? At what point does her reputation become so tarnished? Because clearly she is popular during her lifetime.
I think you really have to look at this in the kind of view of the schism of the church, where you have the Eastern Orthodox Church breaking off, where she is actually a saint. And all of the accounts of her life, a lot of them are probably quite whitewashed. One of them, I think, that was written in 1200 even, says that her father was a priest, which is a far cry from a bear trainer.
Yes, this is presumably at the point where priests were of the Marian kind.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So it's in that tradition in the Eastern Orthodox Church, I think she's definitely been given the Madonna treatment, right?
Okay.
And then if you look at the Western Church and you have Procopius's account, The Secret History, that was published in the 1600s.
And that was sort of the definitive text, really.
Yes.
Because she wasn't sort of much remembered during the interim?
She was. So you even have people, you have this famous canon that was writing about her as a succubus in the 1200s.
Okay.
So she is like a kind of notorious female figure in the Western Church. And I think a lot of that was because of her status in the Eastern Church and her influence in building churches and building the Hagia Sophia. She was really involved in the foundation of the theology of the Eastern Church.
I mean, it seems, I do not know much about Eastern Orthodoxy, but, you know, I can't really imagine an equivalent in sort of the early Western Christian Church, because it's, you know, other than the Madonna.
And I think there were women that were really interested. For example, we were talking about the Book of Judith recently,
yes,
right? Which is left out of some
That's
copies of the New Testament. So I'm sure there were some. We just don't know who they are because of the patriarchy.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there were a lot of precedents set by Theodora, you know, the fact that she was an empress equal to the emperor, that she even took the regency when he was unwell, and also all the laws that she put in place regarding women's rights. To what extent did that have a lasting effect, if any?
That's a great question, actually. So you remember her older sister, right?
Oh, yeah, bless her. She had a moment in the sun.
Well,
so it promising. Turns... She seemed so promising at first.
Yeah. So her older sister had a daughter named Sophia.
Oh, finally someone else with a name, because it's like we've forgotten Theodora's mother's name, we've forgotten her daughter's name, you know, most of the women's names.
Yeah, so her niece, Theodora, by Sophia. Her actress sister.
Or in keeping with the laws of Byzantium, Sophia in...
So Sophia actually married Justin II, who was Justinian's heir. And or who was the emperor
after
Justinian.
They weren't tempted to Justinian Inian.
That would have been amazing.
Yeah.
And she actually co-ruled by Justin II's side, and it was acknowledged even on the Byzantium coins, which is an honor that even Theodora herself did not get. And after Justin II's rule, the Senate came to her and asked her who the next emperor should be. Not once, but actually twice, because she did it the next time the emperor died as well. So she stayed in the palace and ruled as queen even after her husband went on. And I think that that shows how much Theodora changed things.
Yeah, that's incredible.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's absolutely... Wow, that was like a strong matriarchal moment there that was had just there in Constantinople in the 6th century.
And I think after that, you do get strong female rulers. I don't know of any that were ruling in their own right, but at least they were co-rulers. They were mothers. They had power.
Yes. Wow.
So I think the story of Theodora is... interesting, because there's so many different layers to it, right? There's this rags-to-riches Cinderella story.
This is basically Pretty Woman, right? I mean, this is fairy tale stuff. It does seem...
It does. It's like it's an actual Cinderella story.
I mean, did this actually happen? That's serious. That's serious. Yeah. Did this actually happen?
It did actually happen.
Maybe I will marry my prince one day.
I think they're all married right now.
My bear trainer father will be so proud.
But in addition to kind of the Cinderella aspect, there's also, you can see how she's this amazingly divisive figure that is both sanctified literally in sainthood and demonized at the same time. This happens to her again and again over the next 1500 years by the church and then the two different sides of the church.
I mean, what I've loved so much listening to this is that it's kind of given me a window on a period in time and a civilization that I know nothing about. And it just seems incredible to me that, you know, not only has Theodora been written out of history as taught, certainly in schools in Britain, but the whole bloody empire has been.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing stuff.
And I wonder if, you know, part of the reason that it doesn't sit well with sort of like, you know, Western history as written in the West is not just to do with its religious, you know, with its religion, but quite a radically different social structure, one where a woman could wield such power at a time where here it was absolutely unthinkable.
And she puts into place so many laws that are fundamentally pro-woman. So women have protection against unlawful divorce by their husbands. They have the ability to divorce. They're no longer allowed to be killed by their husbands. They have ability to own property. They suddenly have custody over their children. Like, all of these laws are incredibly progressive.
I mean, isn't it alarming, though, that in the 19th century, women in Britain, certainly, were fighting for those same rights? You know, we like to think that there's this lovely linear progression towards, like, female women's rights. That's not how it works. And just as easily as that was written out of one culture's history, you know, whatever's taking place here could be written out of another's of future date.
You asked me earlier, like, why has she been written out of history? I think you just hit the nail on the head, is because she brought about so many social changes and things that were then taken away.
Also, we did not steal any good artifacts.
Yeah, British Museum, your Byzantium collection is a little lacking, but we still love you.
Yeah, we really do, actually. Well, Sarah, I really, really enjoyed that. And I just learned a lot, actually. And I'm kind of really struck by all the points of continuity I guess, between Byzantium as was, or Constantinople as was, and the world of today, bread and circuses.
Well, I hope you guys all enjoy that, and maybe you'll go and do a bunch of research on Sophia and tell us about that.
Empress Sophia. And Justinianian.
We're just in the second. Yeah.
Well, Sarah, I thank you. I'm now going to take you downstairs and shower you in cheese.
That sounds amazing. Can we bring the geese?
Don't worry, I will. I've already got the grain in my loin cloth. and I prepped one for you too. Okay.
Thank you so much for joining us. This has been Demons and Dames. Bye.
Bye-bye.
We sit in coffee shops and discuss the subject of flock. We speak of our men folk, then we give up.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Demons and Dames.
We will respectfully encourage you to rate us, to review us, and to recommend us to your friends.
And enemies.
It might make you like them a bit better. You can follow us on Instagram at Demons Dames Pod, on Twitter at Dames Demons.
Or you can get in touch with us via Facebook or demonsanddames@gmail.com.
Bye!
He says that he loves her, but never does anything for her that she couldn't order.
Eat their hearts, suck their vile jellies from them.